India is a land of industrialists and micro entrepreneurs. The Tatas, Ambanis, Birlas, Adanis are household names, which is why B2B manufacturing and companies built around B2B have been very large and famous in India. At Z47 also, we have been investing in B2B companies for over a decade now. And we are very bullish on Make in India and the kind of companies that can be built around B2B and manufacturing. However, in the last couple of years, at least in private markets, B2B companies have gone out of favor a little bit, which is why I thought I'll get Avnish and sort of chat around what's happening in overall B2B and about the B2B landscape. So today's Z47 Zero to Infinity podcast is around, can B2B companies scale to infinity? Welcome, Avi.
And welcome, Sudipto. I noticed that you introduced yourself also. You assume everybody knows you. But welcome. I'm excited to do this. I think last time we did this was maybe in the middle of the hype cycle.
Yes.
So it's actually good to do it at this time.
If I look at India, right, absolute GDP-wise, it's a top 5 economy. It should get to a top 3 economy very soon, and which is why we're very bullish about India. That economy is powered by millions of factories, distributors, wholesalers, retailers. And today, because of overall Make in India and China Plus One, we are also becoming a large export powerhouse. So logically, India should have a lot of B2B marketplaces and companies. But traditionally, it's not a sector that most VCs have invested in. And we were obviously one of the first to invest in B2B with off business. So maybe let's start from the beginning and go back to 2015. What was Z47's thesis back then?
Ashish.
To invest in? Obviously, Ashish. But how did we think of B2B back then? And obviously, you have seen this over 10 years, the entire cycle through 10 years. How has it evolved over time?
Actually, if you go all the way back to my dot-com bubble days, B2B was a big sector. In the dot-com bubble days, there used to be two companies that became multi-billion dollar. They were called, one was Ariba.
Yeah.
Which I think, I don't know if SAP or Oracle bought at some stage, and another one was called Commerce One. So that thought that technology automates supply chains and all that was always there. Then when Ashish was starting, he was initially thinking about at Bazi, when we had to survive and there weren't as many internet users, we survived on the back of B2B. We used to do reverse procurement, reverse auctions for procurement. This Inox that is right
this
opposite
is software
here.
Software or full stack? Just a marketplace for reverse auction or this was full stack?
Managed marketplace. So we would develop the vendors. So this Inox, actually the first Inoxes that opened in India, we essentially the seats were purchased through the Bazi reverse auction platform. So we would develop vendors. Maybe in any auction would be 8 to 10. We also developed forward auctions for cars because we looked at what are all the sectors globally in which auctioning is an interesting mechanism. And at that time, it was more about auctioning than it pretty much became a pure marketplace. So I still remember ICICI's, some of their largest repossessed cars were sold to dealers through our platform. So B2B was ingrained in my head that it is a very core part of the internet opportunity. However, one also realized doing all of this in Bazi that Indian digitization, it was basically phone calls.
Yeah.
We would be making the marketplace by calling people, telling the broker. The broker would tell us, aap meri taraf se bid dal do. Like it was just very, very archaic.
That's what IndiaMart built.
Well, IndiaMart was more thin stack, like
and
Alibaba.
Classifieds.
Yeah, yeah. Payments was broken. No. Think about it, in car auctions, each state has a different tax.
Yeah.
What's the situation today? GST, right?
Yeah.
So, the thought was always there, but the friction for B2B was even more than B2C in India. So, when Ashish was starting out, clearly procurement was something I believed in, he believed in. So, initially he was going to start with procurement engine for hospitals. Then obviously it morphed. So watching that success clearly was one part of it. And how he was blocking and tackling and fixing the issues. that gave some confidence. And then 2016 onwards, the India was changing. Demon happened. I know it's considered a bad economic move by global experts. I think they are wrong. It was the best thing that could happen to India. It digitized a lot of things, including procurement. Even in corporations, there is corruption. There was a lot of corruption in procurement.
Yeah.
Right? So digitization was happening.
And it still is. Procurement is one of the most opaque functions in a corporation, right?
2018, GST, 17, 18, then GST had come. So I remember the first time where we told our investors in 2018. Until then, it's a broader point, but until then, I think India as a market in digital as well as in venture capital was a copy-paste market. What is working somewhere else, let's do that here.
Yeah.
2018, I will say at least for us, it became from reactive to proactive. So from copy-paste, made in the world, copy in India, to make in India for India.
Yeah.
That's the fund you have made many B2B investments in, and we should talk about those. But that was a conscious call. We said the canvas of India. So, you know, you and I have been to China also together. Every time we would go to China, we would come back with basically sad and with FOMO and with envy. And look at their infrastructure, look at what they have built, all of that stuff, right? What we could see, it became obvious with hindsight, but what we could see even in 2018 was that India was getting digitized. So credit to the government, the push obviously on getting Aadhaar done, Jan Dhan done, UPI, GST, everything was getting digitized. So in 2018, we said, make in India for India.
Yeah.
And that was a clear focus and strategy, and which is why we did so much B2B. We did so much financial services, right? Because all of those were very much make in India for India. And of course, as an aside, now we are in all of the above. We are and plus make in India for the world, right? With Fund 4. So what then happened, coming back to the China example, we used to always come back and say, hard infrastructure, we are so far behind that we don't know if we'll ever catch up. Now looking at, I know you live in cities where infrastructure is still poor, but at least for those of us in Mumbai, I mean, it's just unbelievable what's happening on hard infrastructure. But soft infrastructure became apparent that we were becoming the best in the world. And then came COVID. What is the value chain and a day in the life of a B2B company? It's all offline.
Yeah.
They go to conferences. Every negotiation is in person. Everything is, or at best, on the phone.
You go to retail stores, sit with the store owners.
Hard logistics is required. Yeah. There's that, whatever. So many intermediaries. COVID finished all of that. And the economy was digitized and ready. If COVID had happened 4 years prior, we would not have benefited as a country. I mean, it's sad to say that we benefited,
without
but we
UPI
really
UPI and GST and Jio, I think even if COVID would have happened, the rails, both digital rails, payment rails, exactly, would not have been there.
That just changed the game. So to me, the canvas, I think some of it is unique to Z47. You know, we have done Krutrim, we have done Ola Electric. So if I look at the canvas of investing, we are investing behind India's GDP. People think of venture investing, or sometimes they think of venture investing in two buckets. Enterprise, consumer.
Yeah.
We think of our investing as India's GDP, which is why I would say in 2018, it was a conscious call. I know you keep telling me that we have the best B2B portfolio. We will see when they go public. I think so as well. But that was a conscious call that has compounded for us better than we expect. So you've been at the forefront of it alongside me. And I think you've also done a few investments with Tarun. Almost everybody actually has done some version of B2B in our portfolio. How do you see the evolution?
I think for me, the time that you're talking about, right, 16 to 2000, maybe 1920, the railroads of B2B were set up. And I think all the large horizontal marketplaces that are truly scaled today started at that point of time. Off Business, Inframarket, Moglix, Zetwork. For me, that was phase one. I think post-COVID, the larger horizontal marketplaces were built. And from that point onwards, if you remember, we had a thesis on vertical marketplaces, because we realized in B2B, going vertical, you can actually solve a problem 10x better. Because, for example, in B2C, the customer is the same. So once you acquire the customer by, for example, selling a book, you can then cross-sell all other products to the customer, and that's how you make more LTV. But in B2B, if you are selling seafood to a customer, you're not going to sell electronics to them, right? So the customer is different. Generally, supply chains are different. The person who is selling is different. The way transactions happen is different. For example, if you take clothes, for B2B, you will essentially sell everything to a retailer from size S to XL. For shoes, from size 6 to 12. For seafood, a very different basket. Logistics is different, payments is different. So basis that, I think we felt going vertical and deep probably is the right answer.
Yeah.
And that's why at that stage, a lot of these large vertical B2B marketplaces started coming up. And this is like 2020, 2021.
But even the horizontal marketplaces that you speak about, coming back to this customer point, they were generally horizontal to the extent of the procurement wallet of that same customer.
Yes.
Steel karo, cement karo, jo bhi karo. But
they took large GDP portions of GDP.
One of the biggest,
And then if you took infrastructure, then you were actually doing multiple different products, but broadly to the same customer as well, right? So I think that's what's changed in 2020. And that's when we did Captain Fresh, Farmart, WeGrow, Business, and a bunch of other investments happened. Then I think 2021, 22, and that's when we also shot a bunch of videos, was the peak of B2B, right? It was the ZARP era. So cost of capital was zero. So a lot of these B2B businesses, although they were thin margin, they were growing really rapidly and they were attracting a lot of capital, right? So the horizontal marketplaces raised a lot of money and the vertical marketplaces also started getting money. That, I will say, continued till 2022-23.
Why did that happen? Why did ZARP really change the trajectory for a lot of these companies, and therefore we'll come to, you know, kind of quote-unquote the bubble bursting?
Because at that point of time, I think cost of capital was very low.
Yeah.
So even if you're a thin margin business with low ROCE, you were still generating more returns.
Also, isn't B2B, if you look at the nature of the industry, isn't it all about credit and logistics?
Yeah.
Wo credit aap basically free mein de rahe ho.
Because there's no cost of capital to it.
So therefore, you'll obviously boom, and your incumbents or existing people were not going to do that, because they are, many of them were listed companies, many of them were well-run, profitable businesses.
And I know at that point we discussed about a company we'll not name, but somebody was doing a negative contribution margin business and giving 30 days of credit.
Yeah.
Which means you could take the product, try to sell, and if it does not sell, you will essentially...
And paying for the logistics and reverse logistics.
Yes.
So as a customer, why wouldn't I buy like 1,000 things from them and return 900 that I don't want?
Which is why obviously a lot of companies scaled.
Yeah.
I think the rationalization happened in 2022-23.
Yeah.
Capital, obviously cost of capital increased. So cost of credit increased, as well as low, thin margin, low ROCE businesses stopped making sense, right? Which is where if you see a lot of these horizontal and vertical marketplaces now went deep into manufacturing to tap into the manufacturing profit pool. Second, I think now a new generation of companies started to get created, which were manufacturing first to begin with. So they were focusing probably on exports. They were focusing on adding value add in the supply chain through R&D, through build to spec, or designing a product themselves and then getting it contract manufactured, which led to like 10-15% plus contribution margins and end state high ROCE. So if I look at overall B2B over the last 10 years, I think we did horizontal or large marketplaces from maybe 15 to 19. Then we went vertical, then we had the ZARP era. And today most companies that we meet, right, are mindful of all of that and are focusing on higher ROCE, high contribution margin businesses that can actually be profitable from the beginning and require less capital to actually scale.
Yeah.
So that's been the landscape till now, right? But the question still remains, can the B2B marketplaces that have been funded by VCs, and there were so many founders who have built interesting companies, right? Can B2B scale to infinity? And if it has to scale to infinity, what's the path to it? For example, although in private market funding has dried up, if you look at public market, if you talk to bankers and public market investors, close to 50% of all IPOs in the last few years have been what they call as industrial sectors, right? Something around B2B, manufacturing, supply chain. So although in India, all these B2B companies are getting a lot of public money and attention, the private money probably has dried up. So within that context, given you've seen so many cycles, right? How do you think B2B companies should think about scaling?
No, so look, private capital dried up because people, A, zarpara changed. B, there were bad practices being followed. This is a business where GMV, like you said, can be very easily, there is a serious interplay between balance sheet, P&L and cash flows.
Yes.
Much more, you can hide things in 10 different places, right?
Yeah.
In these businesses. What you have said, contribution, like just to educate people a little bit, it's so easy to bear cost of logistics and all of that and drive up, you know, your margin versus drive
down. And showing contribution margin without cost of capital. So if you have 120 days of working capital,
yeah,
and you have 14 at your sort of, your cost of capital is 14%, yeah, 4 to 5 percentage point of your contribution margin actually goes in, correct, servicing the interest, right? So it looks your CM profitable, but actually every trade you're losing money.
So it wasn't being built as dhanda. That, and again, when you talk to some of the founders, one of them said, jab mereko paisa free mein mil raha hai, toh main kyun nahi aise karun? It's actually rational. You could actually say it was rational, right? Because that's a land grab, you're getting money for free. So,
and by the way, the companies which raised money and obviously had all the right practices and checks and balances, they have been able to raise debt on top and have done actually quite well after that.
Actually, that's very important. So when you talk about being built as a dhanda, if you look at, for example, off business, they get rated by the credit agencies, right? And they are therefore raising debt on back of that. And credit ratings by agencies forces you into excellent corporate governance, right? So now let's step back. Why bother? And especially as a venture capitalist in a non-ZERP era, why should I bother with a low margin, high working capital business? Why should I invest in it?
I would argue we should only if it's ROCE is actually very high.
It's ROCE, right?
Yeah.
So it's ROCE. So it goes back to the point we were making earlier about A, the venture playbook for India, and B, for Z47 itself, which is the canvas. If your GDP growth is being led digitally, how can you afford not to play in it? And therefore, we have to play in it. But you have to have guardrails, right? So we have all met public market investors and it's ROCE, ROCE, ROCE. And I think that's, and I would say operating cash flows.
Yeah.
Right? So operating cash flow bana rahe ho, acha ROCE kar rahe ho, toh kyun nahi karenge?
And both there of those are interlinked, right? If you have ROCE, you will get operating cash flow. Yeah. Without ROCE, you can't get there.
Yeah. And the beauty of B2B businesses is they generally have structural moats versus consumer businesses. Abhi dekh rahe ho, you're seeing what is happening in quick commerce.
Yeah.
I'm told Flipkart Minutes is taking share and, you know, new ones will be coming. It's a bloodbath. Fundamentally, inertia becomes a moat. Customer relationships become a moat. So I love that characteristic.
Economies of scale become a moat.
Economies of scale, and they have very high retention. So when you look at characteristics of a business, margin is not the only one.
Yeah.
You have to look at all these characteristics, which is why public market investors love this stuff. If India is going to get industrialized, which it is heading in the direction of, again, we have invested in some of those, and it is digital first, then these things have to grow. We have met public market investors. They like it. Their question always is moat, margin, do you have enough differentiation to be able to basically hold on to it? If you look at going forward, I think we as VCs, you know, we all love the Swiggy IPO, Zomato IPO, Ola Electric IPO, all of that stuff. But that's not the bread and butter. Small cap and mid cap is the engine of the economy.
Yeah.
It came up in the budget that MSME was one of the 6 priorities, right? So my view, we would be very happy going forward where we invest in companies and they go public anywhere, let's say, 5,000 crore, 4,000-5,000 crore, and grow in the public markets. And there are plenty of those opportunities. Public market investors have told us that, right? Key is, because as a venture capitalist, you also need to exit. You have to look at liquidity, all of that. If they are profitable, you can sell into the IPO, right?
Yeah.
So very excited about it. I actually believe, I'm a big proponent that the market needs to correct. I'm hoping some version of the correction is happening because there's been too much froth built over many years. But when the next cycle comes, right? Typically, primary market shut for about 6 to 12 months. When the next cycle comes, I'm hoping many B2B companies in our portfolio and in the market, this becomes a new asset class. And hopefully it, you know, does well for all of us. You've been meeting public market investors. What have you heard?
Add there, but before that, in two thoughts just from the company's perspective, right? I think for a lot of B2B companies which get to profitability much faster, public markets might also be the best way to grow, because once you become public, your cost of debt drastically reduces, because you are profitable, you are a public company, your corporate governance is not under question. You get access to cheap debt at 7.5-8% versus in private markets probably where you are paying 12-14%.
It's a very good point, because again, as a VC and a VC portfolio, there's venture debt, but we don't think of our companies tapping the normal quote-unquote debt markets, right? Whereas in B2B, it's a must-have.
That's how all companies have grown, right?
And
even for venture investors, I would argue there are a lot of companies probably which can go from 0 to 4,000 crores, 5,000 crores in 4-5 years.
Yeah.
And we as being investors with fund cycles of 10 years or more, for us as well, it might be better than instead of thinking of Series C of a company, take it public and then hold the company as it compounds in the public markets.
Yeah, absolutely. My only guardrail on that is public markets are very unforgiving. And so what we should be guiding our founders and founders in general should be having predictability in their business.
Yeah. Right?
They should not be worrying about the quarterly call aane wali hai aur result kya hoga.
Which is fair, and which is the maturity of the business.
Yeah.
And I think back to what I think it's broadly the same, right? I think if you're a B2B company, first, I think it's profitability over growth, because especially in B2B, if you're not profitable, it is very difficult to even ascertain what the PMF is, because the PMF comes at a cost or a price. And in B2B, being profitable, PMF with profitability is the right PMF to think about. So I think first is profitability. Second, as we discussed, right, it's ROCE. Because if you're till the point your ROCE is greater than your growth, you're operating cash flow profitable. When your ROCE becomes less than your growth, you essentially
which is all non-dilutive growth,
which
point.
Is all becomes dilutive. And people are obviously today the markets are great, and if a company is growing really fast, you can raise money through QIP. But the challenge is the moment the market moves from a bull market to a bear market, the QIP stops.
Yeah,
and public market investors would have underwritten your growth and paid the price of the growth, but the growth will significantly fall the moment the QIP does not happen, which is why they don't like it, right?
No, but I think this is a very important point for founders to understand, because we've talked about non-dilutive growth. What that means is, and I have had public market investors tell me, as an example, HDFC Bank, and I may get the numbers wrong, but directionally right, over the last 30 years, supposedly, has done one or two QIPs. So basically, it was funding through profits. Now, the new era of investing in the public markets, to even fund or to even back loss-making companies. But they want the company to raise enough money in the IPO.
Yeah.
Such that they don't need QIP to grow.
Yes.
And they typically say, humko 3 saal ka paisa aap raise karke.
Yeah.
Humko dilution nahi chahiye, right? This is very important. And in fact, the joke, one of them, I think half jokingly said, you guys love, as private investors, dilutive growth because you get markups. We don't get markups. This is, you know, every dilution is basically a markdown for us.
As I said, right, your growth is dependent on that round, and if it does not happen, you're priced
then,
in a particular
growth. Then you actually become existential risk.
So the predictability of the business goes away. And as a public market investor, what you care about is predictability.
That's the key, because I know we were going to talk about what does it take to go public, and maybe we should just, to me, that's the single most important operative word is predictability. Especially if you're going to go public at a subscale. Technically speaking, 4-5,000 crore ka IPO market cap ka subscale.
Yeah.
Right? Why do it? Why do it? Because grow in the, you know, let the public markets finance you.
Yeah.
And grow with it. No. 4-5,000 can become 50,000 at some stage. Right?
And I think,
but uske liye predictability bahut important.
And I think if you look at companies which have done that really well, right? I think Dixon would have IPO'd in the 3.5-4,000 crore range. It has grown 30x since IPO. Keynes probably has grown 8-10x. Sona Comstar, I have to check, but probably 6-7x. RVNL would have grown more than 10x. So in the last 2-3 years, there are a lot of these companies which IPO'd at 3-4,000 crore range, but now are multi-billion dollars.
Yeah.
And they have been beating plan or meeting estimates of plan quarter on quarter.
And that's the key to know why that it's not a bubble. It's not multiple, random multiple expansion. Their numbers have been great.
There's some multiple bubble expansion. And there's some multiples, but if you look at forward-looking projections, maybe 18 months out, all the companies that look 150x P, if you look at the order book and if you underwrite their forward-looking projections, they're all at 40-50x P. Now, what gives people confidence to underwrite it? And that's the execution and the predictability.
Correct.
Because of which they're comfortable. You've done it for 18 months, they will give you forward-looking multiples of 18 months ahead, right?
Yeah.
But with that context, maybe a quick rapid fire and getting your thoughts. If there's a B2B company today and raise Series B, reasonable scale, how should they think about what's the minimum scale size at which they should start thinking of going IPO?
See, bubble period mein toh kuch bhi ho sakta, but I think of these things as saying, typically I'm a believer in fundamentals of PEG, which is PE and growth rate.
Mm.
Now, depending on the nature of the business, many of these may end up being more EBITDA rather than PE. You will hear multiples, like especially from the bankers, 35, 40 times forward. I believe that they sell you that and you will go public at 25 times forward, which is still a very, you know, the slow growing conglomerates in the world trade at single digit, used to trade at single digit EBITDAs before ZUP.
Yeah.
They'll go back to that because you have to basically look at interest rates and this. But I think with the kind of growth we are talking about, which is why we said PEG, I think 30, 40, 50% grow kar rahe ho, toh 25 times forward mil jayega. So do the math. 5,000 crore chahiye. Agar minimum, toh 200 crore you need in EBITDA. There are many companies that are going to be above this, even in our portfolio.
Yeah.
Aren't there companies, Captain Fresh is already at it.
Captain Fresh is already at that.
Trailing basis, not
yes.
forward.
Obviously, obviously is at a significantly higher scale, but there are a lot of other companies which can hit that in the next 12 to 18 months.
But I'll tell you what I've heard, and you've also met the public market investors, so you should add. You know, the Warren Buffett moat, I truly hear from public market investors. They really care about moats. And, my previous statement that B2B companies have structural moats is not good enough. I think you really need to think about moats in your business building. What are the moats that you've seen?
As you mentioned, right, in B2B also there are 3-4 different moats. One is a brand and trust moat. I think that's the biggest moat. So if you have a brand in B2B.
Brand is the ultimate moat, but it takes forever to get there.
Forever to get there, right?
So, and I can't, as a founder, I don't know how much of that I control in the near term.
Which is true. Second is, I think, customer level moat and relationships, right? If you have customer cohorts that are expanding over a period of time and you can sell more and more to the same customer, which in some shape and form is trust, right? That's the moat. If you're selling cross-border and doing exports, ability to having that customer on your that relationship itself is a moat because it's not trivial to build that relationship, right?
Yeah.
If your tech is giving you operating
leverage, which is what you said earlier, and I'll bring in what Ashish said, our own thinking evolved to saying, B2B karna to full stack karo. And Ashish, when I was speaking to him once about M&A, he said, I never buy revenue, I buy margin. That was a very thoughtful statement, which is I will forward integrate or backward
integrate.
I will not horizontally expand, which is a very good point. And he had a further nuance on it, that when I'm forward integrating or backward integrating, I am working with an existing relationship. If I'm doing horizontal, I am working likely with a competition.
Yeah.
And the cultures won't integrate, which was very, very good. So I think he's done it really well. So to me, forward and backward integration is the ultimate mode. Because once you have a margin structure, you know what?
That others can't compete with. Yeah.
Classic Bezos statement that your margin is my opportunity.
Yeah.
So I think, and Reliance does it really well. Look at everything they do, they go full stack. Fiber bhi le karenge.
Which is the economies of operating leverage combined with economies of scale that will enable you to service a product at the cheapest cost, which your computer just can't compete with, right? That's fairly interesting. So moving from that section, right? If you think 2047 backwards, and now we have spoken from 15 to now, but looking 25 years forward, obviously Z47 is obviously 2047. Something very aspirational to all of us. Looking 2047 backwards, which sectors in the broader B2B manufacturing, make in India, sectors.
I will turn this back to you. I wrote all my sectors in my founder's note. I'm hoping the team will link that here. I actually think it's one of, I know I often rib you guys on, you know, don't say why not, say why. But actually, when it comes to sectors, I think why not? Right? Mm. There are so many sectors that we should be in. But I think you actually had a very good framework, which was more India's strategy backwards, what we should be thinking. So you should talk about it and then we can talk a little bit more about sectors.
So I think we have discussed that, right? And when I think 2047 backwards, obviously it's a developed nation and the $4 trillion GDP gets to 30. But more importantly, we also need to be a really sovereign nation. Now, where does sovereignty come from, right? Where you can truly take your own decisions and serve your own people well. And with sort of that point of view, if I look at sectors, first is agri and food security. The country should produce as much food required for its population and should not depend on anyone else, right? Second is infrastructure sovereignty and excellence, where we have our roads, rails, metros, enough amount of houses built for the country. Third, very importantly, in today's age is compute sovereignty. You cannot depend on another country for chip design, some other country for chip manufacturing, some other country for mobile assembly, or someone else to build your data centers. So within compute, at least I look at it as semiconductors, data centers, and the overall electronics manufacturing happening in the country. Fourth is energy resilience. You can't depend on another country for oil and think about being truly sovereign in nature. And oil is the new gold, right? So then you look at generation of energy, which is renewable energy, storage of energy, which is battery, and then use cases of energy, where you obviously have EVs. And fifth, obviously, and which is the most obvious, is your defense sovereignty, right? And that has surveillance, which is space tech and satellites and rest of defense. So for a country in 2047, hopefully to be the best country in the world, at least agri, infrastructure, compute, energy, and defense, we should be best in class. Now, for us to go there, right, there are obviously businesses that are in supply chain, businesses that are in manufacturing, but more importantly today, deep tech is becoming very interesting with that lens, because a lot of that intelligence needs to be built in India for India. And I would at least, from a 2047 lens, think that these are the sectors which are very
exciting. And all of them, many of them are, I would say, compute, space, defense are here and now. The others, some of them we can't, but you know, sometimes one doesn't, as a venture capitalist, say, okay, how do you play infrastructure? But for example, material science, how much is going on in new materials and stuff like that? Climate comes in somewhere here, right? I actually think these are all, like I said, we are privileged to, being a VC in India is so much easier, because in the US, fully developed market, so much competition, you can't play all sectors. I think this is very, very interesting. Going forward, the question is, and because we have looked at some of these sectors, what do you think is holding back, like, so many companies that we could invest in these sectors?
If I look at today, right, and 5 years back, I think structurally there were a lot of challenges. Today, if I look at the structural challenges, there's enough amount of capital. I think there are a lot of investors who want to invest in this sector. There's also a lot of government support, which actually did not exist maybe 10 years back. Today, we also have the customers. Like if I look at space tech, the Indian government wants to buy good quality satellite data. If I look at any customer in India, they want their data centers to be co-located in India. The data center companies actually don't want to pay NVIDIA $30,000 a rack. They want somebody to actually build AI inferencing for India or AI training for India, right? I think the place where I still feel there's a little bit of gap is just on the talent and ecosystem, which needs to be developed for us to compete.
But let's talk more about that, right? Because one of the core things we say is that India, by the way, has always had great talent. All the top CEOs in the world tend to be Indian. So let's take semiconductors as an example. 90% of the world's semiconductors move through Bangalore, because Cadence and TI and everybody, you know, Synopsys, everybody, Mentor Graphics. So then what's the talent gap?
In Bangalore and as a diaspora, we probably have the best chip designing people in the world. But in India, we still lack the entrepreneurs. And when I'm talking about an entrepreneur, who is someone who is thinking, how do you build a $10 billion company, and not thinking, which is the best technology out there, right? Yeah. Which is a lot more capital raising, customer backwards thinking, selling. and then getting to the product. I think we have very good people just on core technology.
No, and we have, I mean, very few Bhavishes, right? Somebody who's going and doing the compute for India and doing the models for India. My request to anybody who's listening to this is, I also believe that they get into their comfort zones, right? I think you were telling me that if you're working at a TI, you're making 1-3 crores a year as a senior chip person, they're just too comfortable.
Yeah.
They don't want to get out. But if not now, then when, right? We had again put this in the founder's note, which is a quote from Bhavish, which is, in these times of a country's journey, ambition is not a choice, not an option. It's a responsibility. And I think we have the talent, but mindset has not opened up, right? To say we should do it ourselves.
Got it. Fantastic. Thank you so much, Avi, for doing this. I think just recapping our entire chat, right? If we look at overall B2B and manufacturing, we continue to be bullish on broad Make in India trend lines. I think overall the country has seen a lot of supply chain businesses which have become large. Hopefully in the next 2-3 years, a lot of them will go public. I think for all the B2B founders out there, think going public early. And the key to that we discussed, you need to be profitable. You should have ROCE. Your moats need to be clear. And you should focus on operating cash flow and non-dilutive growth. And interestingly, if I look at Make in India, I think we've moved from supply chain to manufacturing and now truly towards deep tech. So hopefully we see more and more entrepreneurs building in deep tech, which are the core technologies driving some of these sectors for broader Make in India and hopefully for the vision towards 2047. So thank you, Avi. Thank you so much for listening to this and to Make in India.
To Make in India and to the founders who are sitting on the sidelines, I have FOMO. Again, my investors are not allowed to watch this. I have FOMO. I think this is the best time. But we had another podcast on AI. So many things are coming together. And I hope that entrepreneurship keeps up and rises to the challenge of the opportunity.
If you like this episode of Zero to Infinity, there are so many more that you must check out. If you like Indian startup content, hearing about founder journeys, or knowing more about emerging sectors that we're investing in, Zero to Infinity is the channel that you need to subscribe to.